From ABC News, this is Perspective. This week's stories and why they matter. I'm Sherry Preston. Coming up, guilty verdicts in Brunswick, Georgia, for the three men who killed Ahmaud Arbery.
Race was definitely in the backdrop, but not in the foreground of this case. You know, you can't claim self-defense when you're the instigator.
COVID is getting all the attention these days, but it's far from the worst disease the world has ever faced. We'll introduce you to a few others.
Ebola, tuberculosis, yellow fever, cholera outbreaks, smallpox is quite possibly one of the worst. They are all terrible. It sort of depends on how you measure it.
And City of Angels, City of Death. A new series follows Los Angeles detectives as they track down some of LA's most notorious serial killers.
We didn't really realize how big it was going to get until after the second or third serial killer. We're faced with something entirely new that even our senior partners didn't really understand.
All ahead on Perspective. It was a case that might not even have come to light if one of the defendants hadn't taken video of him and his friends carrying out the crime, shooting and killing 25-year-old Ahmaud Arbery in the coastal Georgia town of Brunswick in February of last year. ABC's Derek Dennis was there as the guilty verdicts were handed down for Gregory McMichael, his son Travis, and their neighbor, William Roddy Bryant. Derek, the McMichaels and William Roddy Bryant were white. Ahmaud Arbery was black. Race was the most prominent factor in this trial, but in reality, when it actually came to the trial itself, it was mentioned very little, wasn't it?
Yes, it was something that trial watchers and activists certainly talked about, that race was definitely in the backdrop, but not in the foreground of this case. And that's because many believe the prosecution didn't need it. They had video of the incident. They had the facts of the case. They had the 911 call made by the defendant, Gregory McMichael.
911, what's the address of your emergency?
I'm out here at Satilla Shores. There's a black male running down the street.
Satilla, where at Satilla Shores?
I don't know what street we're on. Stop right there, isn't it? Stop. Travis!
He sounded angry. He sounded agitated. He yelled out for Ahmaud Arbery to stop. And the prosecutor pointed out that Arbery was under no obligation to stop. In fact, he was running away from them. So the fear factor that the defendants tried to claim just didn't work. And also the prosecutor pointed out how, you know, you can't claim self-defense when you're the instigator. You can't instigate a dangerous and potentially deadly incident and then turn around and claim self-defense. So those were her two main points in her closing arguments and throughout the trial. And I think it really resonated with the jurors.
It was a week ago that we found out the verdict in the Kyle Rittenhouse case, another one that claimed self-defense. What were some of the people who you talked to, both inside the courtroom and outside the courtroom, saying about that and how the two cases compared?
The self-defense claim came up in both cases, but the communities were so different. I mean, in Brunswick, Georgia, this is a small coastal community, very tight-knit, but also spread out in a sense. There's a lot of land separating neighborhoods and communities. So it's not a big urban center. So we didn't get the big activists, the big protests, the big commotion that we saw in other cities. And I think the real difference here was just the facts of the case. They seemed to be so clear that there were three guys, white guys, who were chasing a black man down who was just going for a jog. And I think people really saw themselves in Ahmaud Arbery, somebody who's just going for a jog, doing some exercise. And maybe, yeah, he went into a home under construction to look around. How many of us have done that? I know I have. How many of us have gone for a jog? I know I have. I think those facts really allowed people to see themselves in some small way in Ahmaud Arbery. And the prosecutor, I think, really drove that home in her arguments and in trying to discredit the testimony of the defendants.
When will sentencing happen?
Sometime next year. We're in the holiday season, and so there's a lot of delay around the court calendar, so we don't have the exact date yet, but it'll be sometime next year. The defendants all face life in prison at least, because they were convicted of one or both of the top charges in the case, malice murder or felony murder. And in the case of Travis and Michael, he was convicted of both. And so life in prison at least is what they'll be sentenced to.
ABC's Derek Dennis covering the Ahmaud Arbery trial for us in Brunswick, Georgia. Thanks, Derek.
Thanks, Sherry.
According to new numbers from the CDC, COVID has killed more people throughout 2021 than all of 2020, and the coronavirus is not done with us yet. On Friday, we learned of a new mutation of the virus. The state of Michigan has asked for federal help because infections are increasing so quickly, as are hospitalizations. Health officials like Stanford Medicine's Dr. Ryan Ribera says they're bracing for more people to be admitted this winter.
I don't think it's going to be like last winter in terms of cases, and certainly not in deaths now that the vaccine is more widely distributed. But still, with people staying indoors, increase in travel, holiday gatherings, I think we can definitely expect a surge. I know we're preparing for one here at Stanford.
When it comes to deadly diseases, however, COVID isn't even close to being number one on the list. Wait, there's a list? Well, kind of. Dr. Lydia Kang has written a book called Patient Zero, A Curious History of the World's Worst Diseases. And we want to warn you that some of this is a little hard to take. She and her co-author began writing the book in 2019.
So my co-author and I, Nate Peterson, we had previously published a book called Quackery, A Brief History of the Worst Ways to Cure Everything. And we were thinking of doing a follow-up book. We love the history of medicine. We love all the sort of strange and quirky things that you find when you delve into medical history. And we decided that we were going to write about pandemics, and more specifically about the story surrounding how there are some patient zeros in these outbreaks and pandemics. And the next thing we knew, we were actually writing a book about pandemics in the middle of the pandemic.
The White House ratcheting up the war against COVID-19.
I view it as, in a sense, a wartime president. I mean, that's what we're fighting.
Adopting increasingly strict measures to limit the spread as the number of confirmed cases in the U.S. passes 9,400.
Some of the diseases that we're talking about include Ebola, the plague, yellow fever, the 1918 influenza. Is there any one disease that has been worse than all the others?
You know, they are all equally terrible. It sort of depends on how you measure it. Is it, you know, the most people killed? Is it the most suffering that they've caused? So I think there are a couple that would sort of tie for first, honestly. Smallpox is quite possibly one of the worst. And, you know, we're really happy to say that it's one of the very few that have actually been taken off of the face of the planet. You know, we have eradicated smallpox thanks to the vaccine. But in its heyday, it was a terrible disease. It's terrible to suffer from. Huge mortality rate. And let's not forget how it wiped out indigenous peoples in North and South America so many years ago.
How do you die of these? Like, for instance, when I hear of smallpox and I see it on old Westerns, somebody had smallpox. How do people die of smallpox?
So, you know, smallpox causes this overwhelming skin, like what we call an eruption. So there is this rash that's all over the place, and it's such a bad rash that it really breaks down that immunization barrier, which is your skin. It's a big immune barrier. And so all these other infections set in, and it's very easy to die from other things. But smallpox itself is really devastating with a very high mortality rate. Cholera, this is really not fun. So I hope you guys aren't eating breakfast or a meal when you're listening to this, but cholera causes this devastating onslaught of diarrhea. And you just can't stay on top of the fluid intake, and you die basically from just being wrung out completely. So they're pretty awful, awful diseases.
Your book is, it actually does, you know, it's a kind of gruesome topic, but it does have some lighthearted moments. Like one of the things you talk about is the history of the N95 mask and how it's tied to women's bras.
Yes, it is a fascinating story. So there is a woman named Sarah Little Turnbull who worked for House Beautiful. She was an editor, and she was asked by 3M to work on some of these polymers to make these gift wrapping ribbons. And while she was working on these polymers and these fabrics, she thought, you know, some of these would work really well as like shoulder pads inside women's dresses or even bra pads. And later on in the 1950s, she had family members that were ill in the hospital. And she thought, God, there must be something better out there than the masks that people are wearing to protect people. And she and 3M ended up working a little bit more on these sort of bra cup materials. And they ended up helping to create the N95 mask.
Okay, so when I see somebody with one of those on, KN95s as well, I'm never going to look at them the same way again. I'm going to be thinking of that.
I don't think we will, no.
Absolutely. Well, the book is called Patient Zero, A Curious History of the World's Worst Diseases, and we're going to list just a few of them. Ebola, SARS, rabies, bird flu, swine flu, anthrax, tapeworm, the plague, yellow fever, and cholera. So there is no shortage of gross and deadly diseases for all of us, lest we think that, you know, this COVID-19 outbreak is something new. Thank you so much for joining us, Lydia Kang. Appreciate it very much, and good luck with the book.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up, an ABC News colleague is set to travel to space, and more Americans are learning to fly on their own. On Perspective after this.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
On board the next 11-minute flight to the edge of space on a Blue Origin rocket is someone who's very familiar to us here at ABC News. Good Morning America co-host Michael Strahan says Blue Origin owner Jeff Bezos asked him if he'd like to take off, and he said absolutely. He made the announcement this week, saying for him, it wasn't a hard decision at all, because he sees this as the future.
Innovators have been risk takers, you know, the Wright brothers. How would we live without a plane now? We don't think about things like that. And I believe that this is the way of being innovative, creative, pioneers in aviation, now space travel. And it's going to take a while, but I do believe that it will bring a lot of technological breakthroughs and also innovations to us here on Earth. And I just wanted to be a part of it.
What if you have plans to fly a little closer to home, though? And what if you were the one who wanted to pilot the plane? As Americans pack airports this Thanksgiving weekend, reporter E.J. Becker has more on how a lot of them are choosing to get around in the sky on their own.
I had a job I didn't particularly enjoy at that moment in time, and I was looking for a way to find something I really loved.
A very specific story about how they got started.
My husband said to me, well, what do you want to do? And I said, well, I think I'd like to fly an airplane. And his reaction was, well, then go to the airport. So I picked up my car keys, walked out the door, drove to my local general aviation airport, and started flying lessons that very same day.
And Elizabeth Tennyson has been flying ever since.
I am probably one of those weirdos that has known what he's wanted to do his whole life. In fact, I ran into one of these the other day. I had a paper that one of my folks had kept that I'd done in fourth or fifth grade, talking about I wanted to be an airline pilot.
Chris Kirk got his license not long after he was old enough to take the tests. And once he did, he celebrated the best way a pilot can, by flying with his first passenger.
I was 17, just got my license. So I took the plane home and I made a couple calls, and my only person that was available to go fly with me, because I wanted to, you know, you want to go take somebody flying. I called my grandma. She's like, they're lickety split. And, you know, I will always remember that she took the time to, you know, come out and be with her 17-year-old grandson and go flying. I'm going to cry here in a minute.
That first year, most of my students thought I was a pilot.
But Gene Poole wasn't.
I'd always wanted to fly, just I didn't really have the funds, and if I wasn't going to do it for a living, it's a very expensive hobby.
Gene, like Elizabeth and Chris, was fascinated by flying, and all three of them have dedicated some part of their professional and personal lives to sharing that fascination with others, in hopes of growing the general aviation community and getting more people to fly small airplanes. You know, the ones that buzz overhead on Sunday afternoon when you look up and think, I wonder where they're going. Apparently they're going everywhere.
I think one of the things that we've seen in general aviation during the pandemic is the big uptick in people who are looking to use GA for personal transportation, for business transportation, and just for the joy of it. It's a means of getting around that really has no comparison.
Elizabeth Tennyson took that seemingly random decision to go to the airport one afternoon and has turned it into a career focused on growing GA. And it's working.
To give you an idea, between April of 2020 and February of 2021, there were actually more people flying general aviation aircraft than there was air carrier traffic.
Elizabeth helps lead the AOPA Foundation and its You Can Fly program. The AOPA is like AAA for pilots and airplane owners, and the foundation gives out millions of dollars in scholarships to help people learn to fly.
There are lots of scholarships out there to help young people learn to fly. I even hear from groups that tell me they have trouble giving away their scholarship money.
The overwhelming majority of the AOPA scholarships goes to kids, but that's just the beginning. The AOPA has taken flying to kids via STEM education, and that's where Elizabeth's story intersects.
What happens is they get in the class and we take them up in the air.
With Gene Poole.
You know, if you put somebody who hasn't been a pilot up in the air and they can't think of anything else, well, they're probably future pilots.
One summer when Gene was at Oshkosh, a massive annual aviation convention, he happened upon an AOPA seminar about its four-year high school curriculum, and Gene got on board faster than a first-class passenger jonesing for champagne and caviar before takeoff.
You know, here's a free curriculum, and I thought, I'm a math teacher. If I can get kids interested in what math is used for, which is what they always ask, that's all I wanted to get out of it.
Gene's school in suburban Minneapolis is one of 300 across 44 states teaching aviation to kids, almost 10,000 kids every year. The four-year program starts with the history of aviation, and the whole thing is very hands-on.
We'll make a hot air balloon out of tissue paper, and we'll launch it.
By the time they get to year two, they're getting pretty serious.
So in the second and third year, it's really essentially ground school for pilot training.
And the kids that take advantage of it, let's just say some of them really take off.
My first pilot was a young girl, and she got up in a helicopter and she hovered that thing first time, just flying it. And the CFI said, she acts like she's been flying this plane for years. Her reaction was, it's just like a video game.
Since he started teaching aviation, three of his kids have soloed. Two are now pilots, two more are in training right now, and one is doing it on an AOPA scholarship. But Elizabeth Tennyson says the kids aren't the only ones taken off.
We have a teacher who has been with us for several years.
Three guesses as to who that teacher is.
AOPA has 20 teacher scholarships a year.
He told me he applied for the scholarship three times before he actually got it.
It was during COVID, and it was in May on my birthday, actually. Chokes me up a little. We were at my house. All my kids were there, my grandkids, and my cell phone went off and said, congratulations. It was from the AOPA. And while schools were closed down, I spent the summer learning to fly.
His kids in his classes would come out to the airport on weekend mornings and watch him take his lessons and critique his landings.
And the students have learned some valuable lessons from their teachers' teachable moments.
I had a runway incursion on my first solo. It was interesting.
Gene lined up to land on the wrong runway. The FAA frowns upon that.
It could have been a really bad thing, but it wasn't. I had to fill out a 9-page report. I was able to share that with my students and say, you know, the FAA is not there to hassle you. And so I got to go through that whole process with the kids.
And when he went for his check ride, where you fly with an examiner, and if you pass, you become a pilot, Gene didn't pass.
I could talk to the students about how you overcome failure. You just go up and do it again.
He passed the second time around and does note, with a hint of pride, that his kids who've made it to the check ride all passed their first time out. Once you have that license, Elizabeth Tennyson says the sky's the limit.
The ability to fly your own aircraft is really the ability to have freedom.
I think that's why so many people are migrating over to general aviation.
Pilot Chris Kirk says the pandemic has highlighted the freedom and flexibility that general aviation offers.
Freedom from, you know, having to sit next to somebody who might be sick. It's just the pleasure of going back and forth on your own.
Especially when airline schedules have been cut so dramatically. And Chris would know. He flies the 737 for a major airline when he's not at 37,000 feet. He's on the ground at his company, Wild Blue, helping the little guy buy and sell small airplanes.
Maybe in the past, they're like, you know, it'd be nice to get my license, and it'd be nice to go out and learn how to do that, and maybe I could use it for my business. And then all of a sudden, again, it's kind of that awakening thing where they see that, oh my gosh, you know, I could really do this.
So the next time you hear it, and you look up and you see that small airplane and wonder, where are they going? They could be headed out to grab a $100 hamburger.
It's taking your personal airplane out and enjoying, you know, in this case, a meal.
They call it a $100 hamburger because you're not just paying for the ground beef. You're paying for the fuel to fly to get there, too.
You know, those $100 hamburgers are fun when you're taking somebody that's never done it before.
It could be a high school student on a discovery flight as part of their aviation class. Or a newly minted pilot building hours, on their way to a job with the airlines, or maybe they're just out looking for the answer to that age-old question.
Why should the birds have all the fun?
Either way, they're on the move, and maybe you're next. E.J. Becker, ABC News, Kansas City.
As you've heard over and over and over again, this is one of the busiest travel weekends of the year, probably the biggest. People have clearly been anxious to get back out there and see family after missing out last year because of the pandemic. And they're getting there, regardless of crowded airports and high gas prices. The average cost for a gallon of regular unleaded gas is $3.40. That's about $1.25 more than it was last year. President Biden, in an attempt to make things better, is tapping into the nation's oil surplus, the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. But will it make things better? ABC's Brad Milkey and Rebecca Jarvis discuss that as a part of our ABC News Daily podcast. Start here.
ABC's chief economics correspondent Rebecca Jarvis is actually on the road, appropriately, on her way to a story. Rebecca, I mean, I assume you're in an Uber. It's running on gas, I presume.
Yes, I'm in a car, as about 50 million Americans will be over the holiday weekend.
Could you ask your the Uber driver, how much gas prices are? Like, does he notice how much he just paid?
Yeah. Miguel, do you remember how much you paid at the tank? We are in California right now. Do you know how much you paid per gallon to fill up?
$4.69.
Wow.
The cheapest option. $4.69.
Well, okay, so that tees us off just right then, Rebecca, because I literally remember when Joe Biden was elected, conservative critics were saying, oh, you see, gas prices are going up. Experts said, a president doesn't control gas prices. They really can't influence them. Except the president does come out and say, what, I'm going to make gas prices lower? Can you break down this announcement?
So this is a very rare announcement from any White House. We very, very rarely as a country tap the SPR. It's the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. And for the most part, we've only dug into those reserves when there was a major supply disruption like Hurricane Katrina. This is the first time that we're tapping the reserves because prices are where they are. The reality is that this is more of a Band-Aid solution than a long-term solution. Tapping the SPR, while it could equate, according to Gas Buddy, to a 5 to 15 cent decrease in gasoline prices over the next couple of weeks, in the long run, prices are going to be more dependent on the overall supply and demand picture. This is a temporary fix.
But does it work, Rebecca? Like, is this something that would actually change prices quickly?
Well, it could. So the thing is that it's also been very well telegraphed. So the reality, if you look at what's happened to oil prices over the last 2 weeks, they've actually started to come down a bit in anticipation of this move. And on the back end of the announcement from the White House, from President Biden, oil prices were higher. Now, the way that this works technically is that the president makes an announcement that we're releasing reserves from the SPR. It takes about 13 days to release that product, and then it has to be refined into gasoline. Prices can actually react before the physical transaction takes place, and that's what we've been seeing in the oil market. The thing is, again, it is a temporary fix. It's 50 million barrels, essentially. That's a one-time release. That is not a change in the amount of overall oil production in this country. And one of the big questions is, while this is a concerted effort among the United States and a handful of other countries who are all participating in this, OPEC is not. And OPEC controls about 40% of the world's production of oil. And oil is a international market, meaning the overall supply of oil impacts the overall price of oil. And as a result, if OPEC decides not to release more production supplies, then everybody turns to other suppliers like the United States or Europe or Asia, and that cuts into the supply overall.
But that's what I'm trying to figure out, Rebecca. Like, I feel like if the administration thought that this was all going to go away in a few weeks, we wouldn't be hearing this big announcement, right? So I'm wondering if this almost signals that the administration's thinking, geez, you know, the price of everything is just going to continue to go up for the foreseeable future. Is that a possibility?
Well, it's possible. I'm not a political reporter, so I can't get into their minds. But sure, what I can say is that inflation has become a much more significant problem. And we hear this word transitory. It's what the administration has been saying really since the spring, that this would be transitory. Well, what does transitory mean? We are now 6-8 months into this. And when it comes to gasoline and fuel, that's a big part of American family budgets. It's also a big part of business budgets. So you have the price of gasoline also having other ripple effects where it can drive up the cost of other things like your toilet paper or your groceries, because it's one of the input costs the delivery company and the manufacturer are all paying as well.
All right, Rebecca Jarvis there on the road, checking out the prices as she passes by. Tell Miguel good luck with those prices. And thank you for the reporting. Great stuff.
Thank you, Brad.
Some good economic news. Jobs, they're out there. The number of people filing for first-time unemployment benefits has fallen to the lowest number in more than 40 years, the Labor Department announced this week. 199,000 people applied, lower than at any time since 1969. The House of Representatives has passed President Biden's Build Back Better plan, but the fate of that huge package of social programs still rests in the hands of the Senate. Along with expanded child care and health care programs, there are provisions in the plan to help battle the climate crisis as well. ABC's Michelle Franson has more on one proposal for a civilian climate corps modeled after President Roosevelt's Civilian Conservation Corps. Here's Michelle.
Nearly a century after the National Civilian Conservation Corps was carved out, President Biden calling for a renewed and modernized national program to tackle the climate crisis.
The Civilian Climate Corps harkens back to the Civilian Conservation Corps from the 1930s.
Martha Ross is a senior fellow at Brookings Metro. The president's Build Back Better plan includes funding to support programs and core jobs.
They can build trails, they can retrofit homes, they can do electronic waste recycling. I mean, any way you want to attack the climate crisis, the Climate Corps can do it.
Ross says the need is long overdue, not just for the environment, but for millions of young people all the way to veterans looking for a job and purpose.
Because we also have a social crisis. Millions of young people are struggling in the transition from high school through education into a good job. And a lot of them are either out of work and out of school, or they're in a low-wage job.
Ross says for those worried about the cost, just like with AmeriCorps, the payoff would be worth the investment.
They will know that what they're doing matters. They'll be gaining work experience. They'll be learning skills. They'll be earning money. They'll be expanding their networks, both social and professional.
Results communities would see right on their own street corner or strip of land. Michelle Franzen, ABC News.
Throughout the 1970s and 80s, more than 20 serial killers stalked the streets of Los Angeles simultaneously and within miles of each other, murdering and terrorizing citizens until the LAPD's Robbery Homicide Division banded together and tracked down the killers. A new ABC News Hulu series called City of Angels, City of Death chronicles that group of Los Angeles police detectives and shows how they caught some of that era's most notorious murderers, including the freeway killer, the hillside strangler, and the Sunset Strip killer. Let's now introduce you to two of these detectives, Tom Lang and Robert Sousa. I spoke with them recently about what it was like to investigate all of those serial killers at once. What was going on in Los Angeles in the 70s and 80s? And when did you guys realize, you know, this is not normal? Something's out of whack here.
Yeah, the 70s and 80s were kind of a unique time in Los Angeles. It was kind of a victim pool because of the beaches, the sunshine, Hollywood. It was kind of sexual freedom back in those days. And the fact that these serial killings started, we didn't really realize how big it was going to get until after the second or third serial killer. And all of a sudden, we're faced with something entirely new that even our senior partners didn't really understand. I think that LA was just one of those lands of opportunity.
Bob kind of alluded to LA had a huge victim pool, and that would draw these deviant type personalities. You know, you have more people, more opportunity. LA had a large transient population, a large male and female juvenile population. And one of the things that was very common back then it isn't so much today was hitchhiking. Young kids used to hitchhike a lot. And if you look at these victims and all of these serial killing cases, many of them were hitchhiking when they were snatched.
At the time, there were as many as 20 serial killers all, you know, operating kind of at the same time throughout Los Angeles. To me, that's a startlingly large number. I mean, at one time. But what were the people of Los Angeles at the time feeling, saying, and in any of these cases kind of stand out as being a little bit more, you know, that people paid attention to than the others?
You know, the real panic set in with the Hillside Strangler case. These were young girls who were being abducted and murdered. And anybody who had a daughter or a sister, this is when the panic really started, because these were very celebrated cases. Tom handled a case, a serial killer case before that, the Skid Row Stabber. But there wasn't the same kind of press, the same kind of media attention that the Hillside got. And I think that was the beginning of this media frenzy over serial killers. And like you say, there were as many as five serial killers operating independently of each other, all in the greater Los Angeles area. That was hard for us to even fathom at that time.
Another thing that people don't realize, in LA County is a huge county, and it's spread out over a large, large area. And we've got something like 59, I think, there are different jurisdictions within LA County. And the sheriff department, of course, overall has LA County, but you have all these other little cities and jurisdictions in between. We had people getting ripped off and kidnapped, like the one that is a trash bag killer in downtown LA, MacArthur Park, who was taking his victims out of MacArthur Park, which is downtown Los Angeles in our jurisdiction, and taking them out to San Bernardino County, and having his way with them and killing them and cutting these victims up and putting them in trash bags and throwing them along the freeway out in San Bernardino. So we would have no idea what's going on in there until somebody told us, until we actually found out that the victims all came from LA. That's very important stuff. So you have a serial killer that knows what he's doing. He knows that the police don't communicate. So this became a major problem until we finally realized what was going on.
You alluded to that a little bit, Detective Suze, at the beginning, about how there was no DNA evidence. There was no, you know, all the things that you mentioned when it comes to modern crime fighting. What were you using back then? What sort of tactics were you using?
Everything we did was pretty much by a hand search. We didn't have automatic fingerprint, latent print systems. We didn't have, of course, we didn't have DNA. But everything we did was by hand. As an example, on the freeway killer that Tom mentioned, we had as many as three suspects, and they all had slightly different MOs. And in some cases, there were drastic differences. But I remember a chart as we started the task force, we had a chart with 45 different victims, all homicide victims. And as we started sorting through them, looking at each one individually, the method of operation, we're starting to see a distinct difference in those. But we didn't have a computer where we could feed this information into. We had to figure it all out ourselves through dialogue and meetings and what have you. Everything we do was by hand. Everything was on foot, knocking on doors.
What do you guys think the fascination is with true crime now?
I think there's a general fascination with the macabre. And that's what a lot of this is, the torture and what these serial killers do just to make a name for themselves. I think there's a fascination that people don't have the knowledge of. They've never experienced these things personally. They're looking from afar, and they don't understand. And it's just this fascination of the unknown, probably. And man's inhumanity to man comes to mind. And it's almost like these serial killers are out there trying to outdo one another.
It's going to be a great documentary. It is, again, City of Angels, City of Death, the original docuseries on Hulu. And we really appreciate you guys talking to us, former Detective Tom Lang and Robert Souza of the LAPD. And they were members of the Robbery Homicide Task Force Division of the LAPD back in the 70s and 80s, when as many as 20 serial killers were roaming the streets of Los Angeles. Thank you so much, guys.
Thanks, Sherry.
Thank you, Sherry.
Think of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band by the Beatles, the album. What if you were listening to it and When I'm 64 came on before with a little help from my friends? It'd just feel wrong, wouldn't it? Well, that's what one of the biggest pop stars in the world is now telling Spotify about her songs on her new album, and Spotify is listening. If you pop on Adele's new album, 30...
So I hope I learn to get over myself.
And I Drink Wine gets played before Easy on Me...
Didn't get the chance to...
Superstar's got a little problem with that. As she told Oprah in a recent CBS interview, the entire album is a story written, sung, and put in a specific order so she could tell her son about herself.
I just wanted for him to hear me talking madly deeply about who I am and how I feel. Like, you know, and I don't know if I'd ever be able to have that conversation with him in real life.
But a problem is the shuffle on every music player. So Adele has asked Spotify to turn it off. Spotify's response in a tweet, anything for you, removing the shuffle button as a default on all albums. So the next time you fire up 30 on Spotify, it'll go from beginning...
I'll be taking flowers to the cemetery of my heart.
To end... just as Adele intends.
What a cool thing. Self-inflict that pain.
From ABC News, this has been Perspective. Thanks for listening. The show was produced by Anthony Ali. If you want to listen to any of our past shows, you can subscribe to the Perspective podcast. Give us a review if you've got the time. Tell us what you'd like to hear in the future and what you think. You can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also find Perspective and other ABC News shows at abcaudio.com/podcasts. For ABC News, I'm Sherry Preston.